From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how the language of grassroots rebellion, which once served the left, is now being used by the right. We talk with Michael Kazin. His new book, The Populist Persuasion, says that populism has migrated from the left to the right. Also, we talk with Irish writer William Trevor. In a New Yorker profile, Trevor was described as probably the greatest living writer of short stories in the English language. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two mystery novels, and on this Valentine's Day, Mark Halliday reads a poem about a conflict between parental love and romantic love. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. House Republicans are working on the last part of their anti-crime package. Republican leaders want to cut the president's program to hire more police nationwide and replace this money with block grants that states can use as they want to. Representative Bill McCollum of Florida says that way each state can fight crime its own way.
The primary concern of Americans today is to fight crime on the streets in their local communities and to stop the onslaught of violent crime. There are myriads of programs out there that are important to them to do this. And what's good for one community and one corner of the country is not necessarily good for another.
But House Democrats don't want last year's crime law undone. Representative Charles Schumer of New York says the new plan would just encourage more excessive spending by states.
Speaker Gingrich's bill guarantees billions of dollars worth of pork, like tanks, useless studies, or this airplane bought by the governor of Indiana in the 1970s.
President Clinton says he'll veto this bill if it reaches his desk. House Democrats believe they can sustain this veto. Democrats are pledging to fight for President Clinton's proposal to increase the minimum wage. UPI's Bill Small prepared this report.
In announcing legislation to raise the minimum wage, congressional Democrats enlisted the help of several Americans who have been working for and trying to live on the current minimum wage of $4.25 an hour.
I live from check to check with no savings for my children or college or otherwise.
And to right now, my children are laying on the floor because we don't have enough money to afford a bed.
I still only bring home something like $77 a week. It's not enough to support a family of three.
We're tired of living in poverty, and we desire your help for change.
Democrats in the administration want a 90-cent an hour increase in the minimum wage. Republicans are opposed. Bill Small, Washington.
A published report says New York City authorities are beefing up security on Wall Street. New York Newsday says there have been threats made against symbols of American capitalism. There are uniformed officers at both the New York and American stock exchanges around the clock. Plainclothes officers are in the financial district. Authorities are stopping delivery trucks to check papers before they're allowed to enter the stock exchanges. Newsday says Muslim militants want to carry out a high-profile attack to protest the terror conspiracy trial of a Muslim cleric and 10 other people. The Mexican governor of Chiapas has offered to step down today in an effort to end a tense standoff with Zapatista rebels. The Mexican rebels allege Governor Eduardo Robledo Rincon won his seat through fraud. Now Robledo has offered to step down, and he's calling on the rebels to disarm. There's been no response yet from the Zapatistas. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 3 points at 3,956. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. The French government has failed to convince its partners to stiffen barriers against Hollywood film imports. France has prioritized the issue now that it's currently president of the European Union. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French Culture Minister Jacques Toubon has vowed to fight to the end to protect the French film industry from an onslaught of Hollywood imports. His aim is to stiffen the current quotas. They say that half the programs broadcast on European television should be made in Europe, but the quotas are not mandatory. Toubon wants this loophole closed. However, a British official at the meeting said most of the ministers are against tightening the quotas. Sweden, Denmark, the Netherlands, and Ireland are said to be the staunchest opponents. A German official also came out against the proposal, saying we don't have a European car or a European train. I don't see why we should have a European film. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Academy Award nominations are out. Forrest Gump has collected a leading 13 Oscar nominations. It's up for Best Picture, Best Actor with Tom Hanks, and Best Supporting Actor Gary Sinise. Other Best Picture nominations are Pulp Fiction, The Shawshank Redemption, Quiz Show, and Four Weddings and a Funeral. Jodie Foster has been nominated for a third Best Actress award, and her role was in Nell. She'll face Jessica Lange for Blue Sky, Miranda Richardson for Tom and Viv, Winona Ryder for Little Women, and Susan Sarandon for The Client. Winners will be announced on March 27th. There's renewed debate over the safety of sightseeing flights over the Grand Canyon. 8 of 10 people aboard a plane died yesterday when it crashed in a wooded area south of the canyon. The pilot and 7 tourists were killed. Federal officials have been pushing for stricter regulation of air tours and, more recently, commuter airlines in general. Tour operators say their business is as safe as similar operations elsewhere. Yesterday's accident was the 11th fatal sightseeing crash since 1980. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Something's changed in the language of our politicians, according to my guest Michael Kazin. He says the vocabulary of grassroots rebellion that was once used by the left is now used by the right. The rhetoric, once spoken primarily by reformers and radicals, has been creatively altered by conservative politicians and religious groups. Kazin's new book, The Populist Persuasion, is a history of how populism has migrated from the left to the right. Kazin is a professor of history at American University. He's the son of writer Alfred Kazin. Michael Kazin says that in the early days of populism, back in the late 1800s, farmers organized against an economic elite of big bankers, merchants, railroads, and the politicians who defended them. Now, Kazin says, conservatives are using populist language to organize against government bureaucrats and the cultural elite. I ask Kazin what the significance is in the shift of populist language.
Because populism is, I think, the primary language, has been historically, with which Americans, especially white Americans, speak their discontent with power. It means that the whole idea that there's a grassroots uprising is now an idea which is located on the right, the idea that the grassroots uprising is on the right, whether people listen to Rush Limbaugh or support the Republican Party or support the Christian Coalition. The idea now is that the people, with a capital P, are on the right, the minority, the, if you will, even undemocratic minority, is on the left. And that's a big change. And it's very important in America, in a democratic country like ours, for any political force to claim the ordinary people for itself.
Well, who were the first populists against? Who did they see as the power that they opposed?
It was an economic elite. It was the railroads. It was the bankers. It was the commodities markets. It was people who were making money off those who really produced wealth, farmers and workers.
And now who is the power seen as being?
Much more, I think, being bureaucrats in Washington and being this rather ambiguously defined, but nevertheless quite powerful, cultural elite, which supposedly runs the major TV networks and New York Times, Washington Post, some of the major news magazines as well.
Is the idea of a cultural elite a fairly new concept in American politics?
Not really. The original populists in the 1890s, the People's Party, were very opposed to the cultural elite, but they saw this cultural elite as combined with an economic one. That is, they saw the people who had the most money in America also as being amoral and having secular values and drinking too much alcohol and living a high life. But they fused the two critiques, the critique of economic power and the critique of cultural power, whereas now those two critiques tend to be more separated.
You consider George Wallace to be one of the people who took the language of populism and started using it for the right, and in fact using it as an argument for segregation. Can you talk a little bit about George Wallace's place in this shift?
Sure. Well, George Wallace, of course, is a Democrat, and was a New Dealer in his youth and came from a part of the Democratic Party in the South that was really left-wing populist. It was supportive of labor movements, supportive of, in fact, even of white and black cooperation in a limited way. But Wallace soon learned that in the 1950s, as the civil rights movement began and as resistance against that movement grew, that he wasn't going to get elected governor if he continued to talk about interracial cooperation and continued to support the liberal side of the Democratic Party, which was very unpopular in his region. So he began to attack the civil rights movement, but more importantly, he began to attack white elites in Washington and elsewhere who were supportive of the civil rights movement. He attacks the desegregation plans of Washington elitists who are sending their kids to private schools but want to force white children to go to school with black children, even if they have to take buses to go across town. And also, Wallace, most importantly perhaps, drew an interesting kind of class line across American politics. He identified himself as a working man and, in fact, was probably the first presidential candidate in the 20th century to identify himself as such, except for a few socialists. And he was able to get a lot of support from people, working-class white people, who had been dyed-in-the-wool Democrats ever since the 1930s. So he begins to break down the liberal coalition and really begins to claim the core of the populist language of the left for the right.
Have you been following Newt Gingrich carefully and analyzing the language that he's using?
I don't think Newt Gingrich uses the language of populism quite as much as some other figures on the right. I think Gingrich's main passions are libertarian passions. He really wants to free up entrepreneurial energies. He, as you know, looks toward the future, the so-called third wave future. And he, I don't think, is as connected to the concerns and the language of the Christian right or of those who still think their taxes are being stolen by the liberal elite, as some other figures on the right are. I think Gingrich's great achievement is to talk about all the things that the government is doing wrong. And in that sense, of course, he sometimes uses terms like the liberal elite and the government establishment and stupid bureaucrats and so forth. But I think Gingrich is an interesting figure because he, I think, would like to get away from some of the elite bashing that Republicans have done successfully in the last 20, 25 years. But he doesn't want to do it completely because, after all, that's been very successful. On the other hand, he himself is a historian. He understands some of the pitfalls of using populist language because, after all, if you become the establishment, people start coming after you.
Let's look at the Christian right. What about the language it's using?
Well, the Christian Coalition, which is, of course, the major force on the Christian right these days, really uses a language which is quite old in its provenance. Ralph Reed, the leading figure, along with Pat Robertson in the Christian Coalition, in fact, often harks back to the Prohibition movement and talks about how the God-fearing majority is that its values are being undermined subtly and sometimes not so subtly by school teachers who teach sex education, by relativistic ideas of morals in various parts of people's schooling, and also, of course, in the media. And really what the Christian Coalition is saying is that if you left families, hardworking, God-fearing families alone, and didn't tell them what to believe, things would be fine. But there are this meddlesome group of social engineers which always wants to make people different and and pull them away from the values with which they've been born.
You write about how the New Democrats tried to use the language of populism, particularly President Clinton during his campaign. Can you give some examples of that?
Well, sure. First of all, the famous slogan, putting people first,
mm-hmm.
talk about the middle class squeeze, the kinds of decline of income of middle class people, jobs going overseas, that kind of thing. The Clinton campaign in 92, I think, was also quite successful at speaking to the so-called Reagan Democrats, who had been Democrats before but had been voting Republican, talking to them in economic terms and trying to put the cultural issues aside as much as possible, trying to get away from talking about issues like abortion and crime and so forth, and putting the emphasis on the economic plight of a lot of people in the middle of the economy.
My guest is Michael Kazin. He's the author of a new book about how populism has migrated from the left to the right. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Kazin, author of the new book, The Populist Persuasion. Where do you see talk radio fitting in the political landscape now? And what does it say to you about public sentiment?
Well, the obvious, and many people have said it, is that talk radio allows people to vent their discontent on a regular basis and to talk to someone who will agree with the sources of the discontent that they identify and will encourage them to believe that mostly liberals and people in government are the source of it. I think, though, that it's sort of sad evidence for the decline of a kind of participatory populism. After all, being an audience, even being an active member of an audience, is not the same as being part of a movement. It's not the same as building a community of people who are trying to take on the powerful in one's community, in one state, or in the country. And I think there's a passivity, sort of a kind of a new kind of sort of angry passivity, if you will, among a lot of people listening to talk radio, where you can cheer a caller, you can boo a caller, you can cheer the host or boo the host, but it's not the same as doing the hard work of actually putting together organizations, associations to try to change things.
And yet the sentiments being expressed on a lot of talk programs, especially the more conservative ones, particularly ones with huge audiences like Rush Limbaugh's, are being credited with having swayed the election, this past election, toward the, you know, Republican win in Congress. So it's odd, you know, on the one hand you're talking about how it's passivity being an audience, even being an active member of the audience. On the other hand, it's seen more as a voting block now, that audience. And in that respect, it has a lot of power.
Sure, but the number of voters in this election didn't go up very much, if at all, from the number of voters in the last midterm election. And I'm not really sure whether the kind of people who voted for the Republicans and liked talk radio would have voted Republican anyway, whether talk radio was there or not. Certainly, they were encouraged to vote Republican because of talk radio. But they weren't encouraged to do much else besides vote Republican and then sit back and turn on the television and cheer as the Contract with America was passed. The Contract with America, unlike earlier platforms, was put together by politicians. It wasn't put together by grassroots movements, as, say, the People's Party platform was 100 years ago. I think that's a key difference. This is really a consumer movement in a way, more than a movement of active participants, of producers, if you will, who want to make changes in their own lives.
In looking at that shift of language, do you think that people who are more conservative or are on the right today are using any of the language that was developed by the New Left in the 60s or by the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s?
Oh, sure. Well, first of all, Bob Dole, when the new session of Congress opened, said we're going to bring power to the people, which was a slogan which was coined by the Black Panther Party in the 1960s, whose politics is about as far from Bob Dole's as it's possible to get. And certainly their definition of the people is this white middle class, for the most part, God-fearing, hardworking, not wanting to pay too many taxes that we've been talking about. And there's also a lot of talk about rights. There's always been rights talk in American history, but in the last few years, talk of rights has been the rights of white men to jobs and rights that supposedly been taken away by Black people, by women who are claiming affirmative action slots. Talk of the rights of property owners not to have their property regulated by the government, not to be told what kind of environmental regulations they have to obey. So talk of rights has also been appropriated to a certain degree by conservatives.
What do you see as being the strengths and the traps of populism?
Well, the strengths, I think, are obvious. That is, not so obvious. It's our language of, it's our American language of class. It's a way in which one can group together the industrious majority against those who are not so industrious. It's a language of democracy. It's a language of democracy betrayed and redeemed, if you will. The idea that the people would be in power if that power wasn't being taken away from them by an elite, and they can get power back again if they organize. That's, I think, many ways part of the founding ideals of America. The pitfalls are, first of all, that it's been a language which has been identified historically mostly with white Americans. And also, it's a language of blame. It's a language of resentment.
How is it a language of blame?
Well, instead of blaming, for instance, the desire by Americans for a easier, more sensual lifestyle, wanting more and better products all the time, for some of the amoralism which has crept into American culture. The Christian right, for instance, often blames people at the top who are pushing bad values on people, rather than looking at oneself and looking at one's family and looking at what really goes on in people's lives. I think there's a sense in which the enemy is always out there. The people are virtuous. The people are good. It's a kind of naive view, a romantic view of who the people are. And most individuals don't think of themselves as perfect and virtuous. But somehow, when one uses the language of populism, one is talking about the people as a whole being virtuous and moral. And I think that can lead us into a lot of troubles. We have to deal with who we are, with all our faults, and not blame some terrible establishment for trying to make us bad people.
Michael Kazin, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michael Kazin is the author of The Populist Persuasion. He teaches at American University in Washington, D.C. Two new mysteries by acknowledged masters have been published this month, P.D. James's Original Sin and K.C. Constantine's Cranks and Shadows. Constantine explores the rougher side of life in a dying coal and steel town in central Pennsylvania, while James's world is English, elegant, and evil. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says Constantine and James complement each other like arsenic and old lace.
Sometimes the setting of a mystery is so diabolically alive, it overpowers even the most ingenious of plots, the most brilliant of detectives. The Baskerville Estate is in this category, so is the Fen Country of Dorothy Sayers' masterpiece, The Nine Tailors. In P.D. James's Original Sin, evil emanates from a mock Venetian palace overlooking the Thames. Innocent House, as this mansion is ironically known, is headquarters for the Peveril Press, a highbrow publishing firm currently producing more corpses than corpuses. When Adam Dalgleish, James's chilly poet detective, arrives on the scene, the body count is 3 and rising. One of the murder victims, Gerard Etienne, was head of the publishing company, and Dalgleish is hard-pressed to find an underling who didn't have a reason for killing the boss. Etienne was discovered with a stuffed snake jammed down his throat. Nobody captures those little details that contribute to the indignity of death better than James. Here's her description of another victim found floating in the Thames. Beneath the puckered surface of the water, something was just visible, something grotesque and unreal, like the domed head of a gigantic insect, its millions of hairy legs stirring gently in the tide. A few years ago, James was made a baroness by Queen Elizabeth, but the honor was superfluous. James already wears the crown of Queen of the English Murder Mystery, and Original Sin demonstrates why it's hers by right of divine election. Casey Constantine is not as well known as James, but for 25 years he's been plugging away at the mystery game. During that time, he's charted the gloom thickening over the streets of Roxburgh, Pennsylvania, a coal mining and steel town whose prosperity has been dwindling ever since strong unions gave way to trickle-down economics. Constantine's police chief hero, Mario Balzac, has tried to keep the peace throughout layoffs and downsizing. Now the unthinkable has happened. Balzac's own job is on the line. To make matters worse, a SWAT team of vigilantes, some of them Balzac's own men, is taking over the city. A stunned Balzac says to a friend, "People in my department have been doing a polka on me like I'm sawdust on the floor." Balzac's wife wants him to retire so they can move to Florida, but first he has to save Roxburgh from its own worst instincts. I hated Cranks and Shadows, because with every turn of every page, I was getting closer to the end of the last Mario Balzac novel. Constantine has called it quits for this series, and we fans are losing some of the most authentic-sounding working-class mysteries ever written. The unsentimental voices here of old Italian ladies, wise guy bartenders, and tired store clerks come out of the great body electric of ordinary America. They're the kind of people James Agee and Studs Terkel recorded in nonfiction. My only hope is that Constantine will have regrets, and like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle plucking Sherlock Holmes from the Reichenbach Falls, he'll give Balzac a flat when he begins that final road trip to Florida.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional funding is provided by Times Books, publisher of No Disrespect by Sister Souljah. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, an interview with Irish writer William Trevor. His short stories were described by Reynolds Price in the New York Times as works of impeccable strength and a piercing profundity that's very seldom surpassed in short fiction. But Price says Trevor's long fiction is even stronger. Trevor has a new novel called Felicia's Journey. Also on this Valentine's Day, a poem by Mark Halliday about romantic love and parental love. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate has refused to exempt Social Security from the balanced budget amendment. The Republican-controlled chamber rejected a Democratic effort designed to safeguard the program from cuts needed to wipe out the federal debt. Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole says the Senate supported a measure last week that pledges support for Social Security. The measure doesn't carry the force of law, but he says right now everyone is willing to protect Social Security. Dole hopes to finish work on the budget amendment by the end of the week. Democrats are still preparing plans to show support for Medicare, veterans, and other popular programs. Croatian Serbs are permitting a UN convoy to travel through their territory. They want relief aid for the besieged Bihać region. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees is worried about the humanitarian situation there. She says hundreds of people face starvation. The BBC's Sophie Fisher reports.
The UN has had problems in supplying Bihać since last spring. Recently, only about 15% of the food needed has got through. Now the agency fears that without full and immediate access, there's going to be starvation in a UN-protected area for the first time. The most vulnerable group includes children, the elderly, and people who've taken refuge in Bihać from fighting elsewhere in Bosnia. This group, which numbers in the hundreds, relies totally on outside assistance. But a UNHCR official who visited Bihać yesterday said the general population of around 200,000 was living in shocking conditions, eating scraps and watery soup. An agency spokesman said the entire population was starting to starve. They didn't know of any deaths, but the situation was extremely dramatic and was getting worse.
Sophie Fisher reporting. 11 new South African judges have been sworn into office. They'll sit on a court designed to interpret and enforce a new constitution. Several people attended today's ceremony, including many who were once victims of the apartheid justice system. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The Constitutional Court is South Africa's highest judicial body and the final institution created by last year's transition to democracy. It is the first court in South African history with the authority to overrule the executive branch and to reject laws passed by Parliament if they violate the Constitution and its Bill of Rights. The majority of the new court's judges are white men, prompting complaints from blacks and women's groups, but most have strong human rights records. The court president, Arthur Chaskalson, for example, spent years representing anti-apartheid activists in major political trials, including the one that led to Nelson Mandela's imprisonment for 27 years. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
On Wall Street, stock prices were mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained a little more than 4 points to end at 3,958. Advancing issues led declines by a small margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Oscar nominations were announced this morning in Los Angeles. Way out in front with 13 nominations was the motion picture Forrest Gump. Steve Proffitt reports from Los Angeles.
Tom Hanks won Best Actor last year for Philadelphia, and he's the favorite again this year, having been nominated for Forrest Gump. The film also produced Best Picture, Best Director, and Best Screenplay nominations. Jodie Foster gets a shot at the Best Actress Award for her role in Nell. She'll compete against Jessica Lange, Susan Sarandon, Winona Ryder, and Miranda Richardson. A popular favorite, Hoop Dreams, was shut out of the Oscars. Best Picture nominees were Forrest Gump, Four Weddings and a Funeral, Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, and The Shawshank Redemption. The envelopes containing the winners' names will be opened on March 27th. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Proffitt. in Los Angeles.
Flash flood warnings are up for parts of Southern California today. Heavy rain is continuing. The Ventura County area has already gotten more than 2 inches of rain. Officials worry that dozens of homes could be damaged by potential mudslides. Another inch of rain is expected along the coast, with much more in the foothills and mountains. The storm is expected to leave the region this evening. Higher elevations are thought to be able to get up to 10 inches of snow. Northern California has felt the storm. High winds and up to 2 feet of snow are expected in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. The United Nations says the depletion of the ozone over Siberia has reached a record low over the past month. The UN's World Meteorological Association says it's not possible anymore to blame the 1991 eruption of Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines. That sent vast amounts of aerosol gas into the atmosphere. The UN agency says there's a huge area of Asia and Europe that's seen great ozone destruction. Last year, the UN reported another record ozone hole over Antarctica during that continent's spring season. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Irish writer William Trevor isn't famous in America, but he does have many readers here, and they tend to regard him with near reverence. Stephen Schiff profiled Trevor in The New Yorker a couple of years ago. Schiff wrote, "Trevor is probably the greatest living writer of short stories in the English language." Schiff described Trevor as a mild man, retiring and soft-spoken, famously shy. And Schiff observed that almost nothing about Trevor suggests that he could possibly know anything of the throttled romances, blistering humiliations, and freefalls into madness that rack his characters' lives. William Trevor has a new novel called Felicia's Journey that deals with delusion, madness, and murder. Trevor grew up in the south of Ireland, where much of his fiction is set. He moved to England as a young man, where he's lived ever since. He told me that as a child, his family moved around a lot.
We moved around simply because my father was a bank official, and every time he got promotion, the practice was to move the man who got promotion from one town to another in order to put him up a step. I don't know why that was the practice, but it was, so that we lived in seven or eight small Irish towns during my childhood, because he was actually quite a clever and able bank official, and he was rising slowly to the top of his profession, and we all went with him, of course.
Was there anything all the different towns you lived in had in common?
The different towns?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they were all very similar. I think having in common is an understatement. They're almost interchangeable, some of them. They're very, very similar places. As my father advanced, they got slightly bigger and more important, because he was obviously being given a more important job. But it does mean that I have got no hometown, which I rather regret. They're all my hometown, and I even towns in Ireland where I haven't lived, I feel belongs to me somehow or other, because I feel so very, very strongly a provincial, small-town person.
What do you think a hometown would give you that you don't have?
Well, a hometown, I suppose, would give you a kind of coziness, which I don't have. But I'm rather glad, from a writer's point of view, I was speaking personally just then, from a writer's point of view, one shouldn't really have that cozy feeling. A writer is, at least this writer is, an outsider. And I feel outside society, and that coziness of belonging is something I would be very, very suspicious of and wary about, and really wouldn't want to have in the end. It's fiction writers are much spikier people than that. They're beady-eyed and watchful, and you can't do that from inside. You've got to do it from outside the pale, and I feel that I belong outside the pale. That maybe is why I don't live in Ireland.
In a recent memoir, you wrote a little bit about your parents and their unhappy marriage. You described them as victims of their innocence. I wanted to know if you could elaborate on what you meant by that.
Well, I think that my parents, when I said victims of their innocence, all I meant really was that my parents didn't know an awful lot. They were simple people. They didn't know an awful lot, first of all, about each other before they married each other. They didn't know an awful lot about marriage. And I suspect they didn't know an awful lot about love. But they married, and they seemed a a very attractive young couple. My father was a handsome man, my mother was very beautiful, but they were the last two people on this earth who should have married. And we three children grew up with that like a cloud hanging over us almost every day of our childhood, which was a fairly gloomy household at times.
What made them so wrong for each other?
Well, I think that one of the things that made them so wrong for each other, in a strange sense, was that they were both very humorous people. My mother had a good sense of humor, and so had my father. But their senses of humor didn't meet. They laughed at different things. The world seemed to both of them a rather different place, and what was amusing in the world to my mother was not amusing to my father, and vice versa. Now, that may seem a very small thing, but I believe that that's an enormously important thing in marriage and relationships. That if you laugh and are amused at and find interesting the same things, you get on. If you don't, somehow or other there's a blankness on the other face when you make a joke or tell a story. And I was always aware of this with my parents, and that was one of the areas of life which I think was very difficult. There were other reasons why they didn't get on. My father was a jollier person, in a sense. My mother was. He was a more social person, more gregarious person. And also there was the very difficult problem of moving from the towns we've been talking about, from one town to another, which was hard on my mother, but rather nice for my father, because he was advancing in his career, he was doing well, he was making more money, he was able to exert more influence locally and all that kind of thing, whereas my mother was presented with some really rather nasty house which she had to have repapered and repainted. And each time that happened, there would be maybe 6 months of upheaval. And this is not easy for a woman.
My guest is William Trevor. He has a new novel called Felicia's Journey. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Irish writer William Trevor. After college, you moved to England. Did your Irish background feel different to you in England than it had in Ireland?
Oh, yes. I didn't want to leave Ireland. The one thing I didn't want to do at that time, this is about 1952, the one thing I really knew is that I did not want ever to leave Ireland. I wanted to be in Ireland all my life, and I hated the idea of exile, but it was necessary and I had to do it. Now, of course, I see that I probably would have never written anything if I had stayed in Skibbereen all my life, or Mitchelstown, where I was born. You have to travel in order to see Ireland in perspective.
I think for about 15 years you worked as a sculptor before you started to write at all. Did you realize you had a gift for writing before you actually started to write?
Well, I was good at... I was good at English. I was one of those boys, one of those children who was, you know, good at English at school, not good at anything else very much, but I did happen to be good at English. But then I became very interested in sculpture, not painting, but I became interested in sculpture because it just so happened that the art master was a sculptor. And I was a sculptor for a long time. I didn't make very much money. I seemed always to fail to make money when I was young. And I had to, in the end, give that up and get a job writing advertising copy, which I did for a couple of years.
Could you remember for us any of the ads that you wrote?
I can't remember any slogans or headlines. It's a question I'm always asked, and I'm always glad to say I've forgotten them all, because they were no good. I was very bad at it.
Gee, so did that hurt any confidence you thought you might have as a writer?
Oh, no, not at all. No, it's a different, it really is a different thing altogether. The good thing about writing advertisements was that when I went to that job, I wasn't given very much work at first, naturally enough, because I was a novice. And I had a great deal of time on my hands, and I was given a typewriter and endless cups of tea. And, you know, in those days, they would say, write an advertisement for a brand of paint or something, but you take your time over it. You know, you take 2 days to write that advertisement. I say, what do you mean? 12 lines? 2 days? And they say, yes, because it's got to be good, you know, and it's got to be absolutely right. Well, of course, I would write what I could in a couple of minutes and then put it aside. And then I began to write short stories because I had nothing else to do. And that's how really I began to write.
So what were the subjects of the first stories that you wrote?
The subjects of the first stories were, there were stories, I think that the only thing they perhaps had in common is quite a number of them were about elderly people. And I can't really tell you why that was. I wrote a novel called The Old Boys, which is entirely about elderly men and one woman. And I wrote a number of short stories about people who were in the 70s. And I think that the reason I did that was that I was curious to know what it was like to be very old. I was myself in my early 30s. Now that I'm closer to 70 than 30, I write more about children because, of course, I have forgotten in all sorts of ways what it's like to be a child. But when I stopped writing about the elderly, I wrote a great deal and have since written an awful lot about women, because I am not a woman and I want to know more about women. I write all the time out of a sense of curiosity. That's what drives me, as far as I can see, to write.
Well, you're how old now?
66.
66. So you're still not at the age that you were describing, but you're closer to it than you were in your 30s. Do you think you came close in your descriptions from what you can tell now?
Not bad. Not too bad. All sorts of things I didn't know about, which certainly not in those early stories. Kind of perhaps not enough emphasis on the loss of memory, which all old people have. But they're not bad.
You know, even in your memoir, a lot of the memoir is actually about other people you've known or about places that you've been. Your memoir is filled with portraits of others. I get the impression you really don't like to write about yourself very much, that there's two things working here. One is your curiosity of others, and another is a reluctance to explore yourself in a public way.
Yes, I have very little interest in myself. I'm sitting here talking to you, whom I can't see, and I am more interested in you than I am in what I am saying to you. I am one of those people who, for some reason, is interested in other people more than in himself. And I don't know why that is. I don't know whether it's part of being a writer or whether it's just part of being a human being. I have absolutely no idea, but it's there, and I don't reject it. I use it. I use everything in order to write something.
See, that's interesting to me, because I think so many writers are very obsessive people, and usually one of the things they're obsessed with is themselves.
I'm sure that's true, but I'm not obsessed with myself. I'm obsessed with my friends. I mean, I'm very fond of my friends, and I'm very fond of my family, and they seem to come first, and I trail along someplace behind. I don't know. On the other hand, of course, talking like this, one has to say that all fiction is autobiographical in a sense, because it's autobiographical in the sense that I can only write about the physical pain that I feel. I can't write about the physical pain that you feel, because I don't quite know what it is like for you. It's like saying, when I see the color blue, I see the color blue. You may see a slightly different color. So I have to use as a yardstick my own feelings for pain, distress, happiness, everything else. Those are all things which I've experienced, and that experience goes into the characters I write about. So that there's always that autobiographical strand in everything. But it's almost a technical thing. It's almost using myself as a piece of litmus paper.
Do you think of yourself as an interesting person?
Well, not particularly. I would much prefer to hope that people found what I wrote interesting, then that they should find I am interesting. I think that what people get when they meet a fiction writer is the remains of someone, because the bulk of everything in that person has gone into what he has written, or in the case of a painter, gone into what he's painted.
What are you working on now?
Well, I always work in the same way. I work on short stories, and usually a novel at the same time, so that when the novel gets into difficulties, or when I become tired of this particular part of it, or, you know, whatever reason, I can just drop it and begin a new short story. And it's a luxury for a fiction writer to be a short story writer and also to be a novelist. I think of myself as a short story writer in the first place. But to be a novelist as well is a luxury, because I can turn to another craft, because they're quite different. The two crafts are quite different.
How are they different?
Well, you can, with a short story, you can see around it. It's like when having something in your mind that you can sort of see almost in the round. You can sort of see to the end of it, although in fact you may change the end. The end may be quite different and you may begin it at a different place, but you can see much more of it when you begin it, before you begin it, and while you're writing it. With a novel, you can't do that at all. At least I can't. I mean, everything I say is personal. It's purely the way I write. Other people would be quite different. But with a novel, I find that to be able to see round a novel and to be able to see a complete novel, or anything even vaguely like a complete novel, would be like carrying the architectural plans for a cathedral in your mind, which you can't do. A novel evolves much, much more than a short story. A short story does evolve, but simply because of the length. It's a different thing. It's a different product. It's a different commodity. A short story is a glimpse. Essentially, it's the art of the glimpse. The novel is more of a mixture, more of a, I suppose you could almost say, a rag bag.
Well, William Trevor, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
William Trevor's new novel is called Felicia's Journey. He spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in London. This is Fresh Air. They're talking about crime again on Capitol Hill. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what will you have on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Brian Naylor will report on the Republican version of the crime bill, now under discussion in the House. Lynn Neary has a profile of Dr. Lloyd John Ogilvy to be sworn in next month as the new chaplain of the U.S. Senate. The present chaplain is retiring after 14 years. Richard Harris reports on some of the mysteries of sound, including the possible benefits of certain sounds, and a report on the proposal to privatize the air traffic control system in the U.S. For Valentine's Day, the romantic music of trio Los Panchos, and a complaint about the difficulties of getting through the New Yorker magazine.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. On this Valentine's Day, you may have had several reminders of how love today is seldom simple. Here's another one. It's a new poem by Mark Halliday called Separated Father, about what happens when romantic love comes into conflict with parental love.
Separated Father. Driving along the city's edge at night, he obeys all traffic signals with chilly prudence. God might be watching for an excuse to nail him. He has ceased to live in the house where his daughter lives. What could be more wrong? Yet the car is running smoothly. It doesn't know what kind of man is at the wheel. Indeed, most people seem unable to read on his face what he has done. Lone cowboy of the night beyond civilization, he feels ice-gloved in the unmistakable primacy of self, who used to think he'd do anything for his little girl. When he drives past the house at 2 a.m. slowly to see her dark window and believe she is sleeping soundly, he recognizes himself as protagonist of more than one rather dreary short story. But now it's him. It's him, and the moon is so bright. Above his car and later above his tiny new apartment, it is so damned bright that no one, not his wife, not any smart or wise person, can tell him it isn't romantic. Unfortunately, it is romantic. So he has a new phone, and he has one mint wrapped in silver from La Familia, where no one knew he was a dad. And he'll phone the woman who changed the meaning of joy.
Mark Halliday, reading his poem, Separated Father. His latest book of poems is called Tasker Street. Halliday is currently a visiting writer at Indiana University. Valentine's Day is a holiday blessed with a great theme song. Here's one of my favorite versions of the Rodgers and Hart classic, recorded February 15th, 1954, by Chet Baker.
My funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? But don't change your hair for me, not if you care for me. Stay, little Valentine, stay. Each day is Valentine's Day.
My Funny Valentine, performed by Chet Baker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Bentham, Chris Fraley, and Bob Alls. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our program was directed today by Alan Tu and Roberta Shirock. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.